Thank you very much, Mahad. So we're delighted that Dr. Hodan has been able to join us. I already gave an introduction background to Dr. Hodan as a Somali American economics and finance academic, assistant professor emeritus at the University of Buffalo, and with a long experience on issues of fiscal federalism in the Somali context. So welcome to Dr. Hodan. We're delighted to have you, Dr. Hodan, join us because we were hoping that you would be able to talk to us about another aspect of representation in the context of the electoral process, which relates to gender and particularly female representation. So I'd like to give you the floor to give us an overview of these issues around female representation in the context of the election, why they are important, what the prospects are for the 2020-2021 system, and your general perceptions on this very important issue. So again, welcome, Dr. Hodan.
Thank you. I'm very delighted also to be part of this and anything these days that can help women to either get the 30% or even keep the current 24%. So basically what we are experiencing is, or what we're trying, we have been trying, even though we have started very late to talk about the woman quota. If you remember in 2016, the process or the mechanism that guaranteed women to get the 30% were stronger. It was written in a stronger language. It didn't say just we will consider it. It was actually some sort of an enforcement mechanism that ensured at least we got 24%. This was a long process. I remember it was first 5%, then 14%, then 24%. One thing I want to comment is, first of all, we don't normally talk about the challenges because these are the real issues that are confronting women. How to increase women's quota can have both long-run and short-run issues. We always think about the short run because I think this time, maybe it was the first time I heard about women talking about election and how they can increase their representation. It started in March and that somehow fell apart again. Then we started 3 months ago. I myself to blame for, but for me, I was using my voice for the last 3 years to think about and remind the parliamentarians, women from all walks of life, to remember that, you know, the election of 2021 is coming close and we were asleep. But despite the fact that all these issues are there, in the present Somalia, a citizen's attitude toward women is conceptually shaped by four mutually reinforcing factors or beliefs. And that should be the fundamental reason or the challenge that prevents women. No matter what you do, this is the issues we need to think about. The customary law that has become prominent for the last 30 years. Because I grew up in Siad Barre's time when gender equality was just, I didn't think I was different from men or from male or from the boys. So this is different. The new generations, the younger generations have confronted very hostile customary law. Also the patriarchal society. The second one could be misinterpretation of Sharia law. That needs to be understood. Not the real Sharia law, but misinterpretation of Sharia law. And of course, the 4.5, which is the way that human resources are shared, not based on merit or education or experience, but based on 4.5, clan dominates. And clan will not select women. Women are excluded from decision-making, be political, economical, or social. They don't assume no clan obligations. Woman has no fighting capacity. And especially in the last 30 years, when the power to hold gun, the resources out there, women don't have, and also they don't contribute to blood money. Now, with all these things, and I will add one fifth factor, lack of political consensus. It's really sad that as we get closer to the election, that the political consensus will hurt everybody, but will also hurt the more vulnerable groups like women. Now, in reality, we know that women tend to overwhelmingly raise the family. They engage in formal trade. They don't have access to commonly owned resources. They always politically advocate for unity, peace, and also that. But even though they can advocate, they don't have voice. With all that said, how do we ensure now, based on the lack of political consensus that we experience in Somalia now, how to ensure the 30% political quota that women is allocated? Well, my worry is that we might not even be able to get the 20%. We might even lose the 24% we have gained in 2016. Why? The complex, the process now is very complex, number one. Hawaii, it's complex. Now, those who are selecting, now it's not only the clan leaders, there is the clan leaders, the civil society, according to Mogadishu Accord, the last one in September. So you have the process of selecting or electing, whatever that might be, is very complex to me. And what made it more complex is the layers of individuals or institutions that are now part of it, which will determine who will be part of the coming MBEs. So the civil society, the regional government, and the clan leaders. It was already complex with only clan leaders. So now with the current clan mine 4.5, all the factors I mentioned that challenge women to be part of or to become parliamentarian, I think this will complicate things. That's number one. So how do we ensure the 24% we have or even gain some? I can think about a few mechanisms, but also with the current Mogadishu Accord, there is no mechanism that guarantees or enforces the 30%. Or the 24% we currently has, how will that be realized? Is there any statements or guarantees or mechanisms or options, even menu of options is missing from there. To add injury to that is the current indirect electoral process will not add or enforce or guarantee women's quota. So how do we prioritize women to be part of this election or to be selected or even to be guaranteed to have the 24% or even 30% quota? That's in the books. It's not legal. And we know that in Africa, unless it's enshrined in the constitution, these things will be just very haphazard. It will be all based on discretion, and that is not rule-based. And whatever we know, when it's not rule-based, people will just think about it and we'll do it next time. And that's been what's happening, even though I should acknowledge the gain we made 2016. I am worried now because now women's representation is not priority today. The priority today is how to have a peaceful election, how to avoid conflict, how to not to entice hate with all these unemployed youth that are out there waiting for something to happen and might exacerbate the issue. So because of all these issues that's currently in place, I'm worried that the female representation, let alone 30%, this might not be realized. And of course, you look at the statements that came from Mogadishu last meeting when all the political leaders came together, the money that's required for women to pay is too high. Women are the poorest. And even if they have money, they end up supporting the whole family. So if you ask them to pay that money, you're not going to have a lot of candidates unless some miracle happens or somebody actually comes in and helps them pay that money. I have to say, they don't have equal footing in that process. Most clan leaders are biased against women. They think their role is to just rear and bear children, even though we know the role of women, Somali women, is more than that. And it's been proven again and again. But when it comes to political resource sharing, it's always that we go back to rearing and.
Okay, we seem to have lost Dr. Hodan. Hopefully she will rejoin us. I was thinking about what Hodan was just saying about the cost of participating in these elections. And I know, Pauline, you had a similar question about the registration fees, etc. And while we wait for Hodan to come back, I would like to kind of pose a question about that, these registration fees, maybe to Mahad, while we wait for Dr. Hodan. And you mentioned in your presentation, Mahad, that the cost for registering as a candidate is rather high. You know, we're talking about that sort of $10,000, I believe, for a candidate for the lower house. And it seems to me that there's a little bit of a dilemma here, because I imagine that part of the reason for the high cost of registration is to fund the electoral process. And the costs of the overall electoral process are much higher this time around because of the increased number of delegates. And I was wondering if you wanted to say anything, your perspective on those registration costs, because as Hodan was talking about, the costs of registering a candidate has implications for who is able to stand and who is able to be represented. Are there ways to kind of get around this dilemma between kind of funding an expanded electoral process and ensuring that a greater range of people beyond the political elite are able to participate? So I'll ask Mahad that, and then maybe Hodan will join us. Thanks.
Well, thanks, and Peter. I have in this condition of registering 10,000 for the upper house and 10,000 for the House of the People or the lower house, and 20,000 for the upper house is seen as quite high, and it excludes basically important segments of the society, and it gives the space for those wealth businessmen and wealth politicians. And we need to keep in mind that since this is an indirect process, the 10,000 is not the only amount of money that the candidate has to pay. So there are a lot of other costs to incur in this process. So there are many people who cannot afford that amount of money. And we all know that corruption in the last 2016 indirect electoral process was high. And the delegates will definitely demand some amount of money. They are taking some level of risks. Some of them were targeted after the 2016 process. Some people are joining the delegates to get some money. There are no clear processes to fight against this kind of many changing hands. In addition to that, and the registration fee, it's basically unaffordable to many Somalis, majority of Somalis, basically. So the few individual politicians that we knew will come up again and again, and then they will contest for the seats. So in one hand, it's exclusion. And on the other hand, it's a way to fund the electoral process. And the budget that has been approved for the government allocated 7 million for the elections. And that 7 million could be used for the election. But there are also other funds that the international community is expected to contribute to this electoral process. But when we compare the funds that is expected to be officially spent in the election, I don't think it's that much money. It's that costly. And that it could be avoided to levy that huge amount of money for just registration. And the irony now is that the upper house, the 54 upper house members, is struggling with mandate crisis in the last 4 years. They have less powers. They don't approve the cabinet. They don't approve the prime minister. And more recently, they were allowed to approve the budget. So they were struggling with mandate crisis. Their mandate was not clear. It was the first time that the upper house was established. They had less powers than the lower house. And all of a sudden, if you have to compete for a seat in the upper house, you have to pay double amount of money that the one who is competing for the House of People pays. So the logic is basically very simple. It is, let us level what has been agreed in 2016. So in 2016, the lower house was 5,000, now 10. The upper house was 10,000, now 20. And that will go on. And imagine a member of the upper house paying 20,000 just for registration. What would you expect when he or she is elected? They will most likely try to regenerate that money through other illegal means. So basically, it is commoditizing the politics. Using this position is as a business investment and generating income when you are in office. So it's a bad precedent. And I think civil society and all stakeholders could raise their concerns over this. And its implication is for the governance and institutions in the country in the future.
Thank you, Mahad. I see that we have Dr. Hodan, who's been able to rejoin us, which is excellent. Dr. Hodan, you were cut off in your presentation. Would you like to add anything?
The only thing I really want to add is that to say, in order for us to not to repeat the same mistake again, we should think about woman representation, political representation, and so many other things to talk about. But the current one is to think about the long run and the short run. The short run is what I talked about, how we can ensure and guarantee the 30%, 24%. What mechanisms do we need? The election committee should be given tools and mechanisms and enforcement, not implementation and enforcement. And there are different models that's been used. We can actually put our heads together and think about how to ensure that. Say if one clan has more than three, it has to be forced that they will bring one of them should be women. for sure, if certain clan has one person, you can be guaranteed they will not give it to women. But then to maneuver and look at those options we have. So that's one thing. So that's a short run, which we all catching up very quickly. And all of us are just saying, wow, what an awakening. This is not going to happen. But I think for now, it's time to establish a long-term plan. We will not be in the same place in 2024. So that's another thing that people are being sidelined to think about what processes we need. Another problem we have is even women themselves right now have been used against each other. So in that case, you know, what's going to get lost is going to be their own goal and objective of ensuring that at least 30% woman quota is realized. And even if that's not, I'm really worried. I'm a very optimistic individual, but with the way things are going and the way, you know, we don't know what the process will be right now, but the fact that the political consensus is in jeopardy now, and the fact that there's a lot of issue going on, woman quota might be just a backdrop, might not be. So anything we do now to advocate to make sure that at least 24 is guaranteed and make sure the other six could be maybe separate, that's one option. But also there's going to be another option where you can put women there, the 30% aside. So they don't even compete with guys. They can compete with another woman. So they can, at least we know that that's guaranteed. That's one way to do so. So options are available, but who are we giving these options to? The election committee must be trained. If there is no legal mandate, I mean, it becomes a gentleman's agreement. So that is what I wanted to say. We really want that to happen. We want to realize the 30% or at least maintain the 24%. I was on Shabelle Radio a few nights ago. We're just saying when we're talking to politicians, we're talking to clan leaders, we want to talk to election committee when all of them come together and then just make sure that, you know, this is one of the main pillars of the election of 2021. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hodan. I was going to ask about specific mechanisms that you thought were available in order to preserve or increase the proportion of women this time around. And you've spoken to some of those specific options that are potentially available. So thank you very much for that. I would like to move on to some of the questions that are coming from the attendees. I think the first question that came through was from presumably a representative of UNDP, because that's the username. The question was the Federal Election Implementing Team is moving ahead with its mandate in line with the National Consultative Committee political agreement of September 2020. What is the likely impact of conducting this transfer of political power, the elections, without the other states, so Jubaland and Puntland? And I think, you know, Mahad, you alluded to this in your discussion. We know there is a political divide, Jubaland and Puntland on one hand aligned against the government in Mogadishu on these issues. What is the impact of these things going ahead without reconciliation of that particular divide? So either Dr. Hodan or Mahad, would you like to have any thoughts on this?
Let me just say one thing. If you remember 2016, one thing I always that comes to my mind, or even 2012, all that process is you have the leaders, the seven leaders or eight leaders or eight men or seven men, I call it. There was technocrats behind them. And whenever there is a conflict among them, they will send the contracts out and they will come up with a workable model. So mostly it was based on consensus. When I see all the leaders, especially of late, and they all have a different interest and all have a different, grievance, I think you will expect this thing to happen. I think it takes a real leadership for all the regions to come together. So I will assume you asked me a technical question. Maybe it's a legal question. I'm assuming the country consists of federal government and it has five member states, plus the Nadir. So if two of them are missing and they have at least combined, they have more than 100 something parliamentarians. I'm not sure if I can answer. I think it might invalidate, it might not. I'm not sure. That's a legal question. But the constitution doesn't say anything about it. We have a temporary constitution that was never rectified. Then the rest is going to be a political consensus. Again, political consensus, political consensus, political consensus. So if there is two regions missing and three others are there, the outcome to me might be, you can say it's legitimate, it's not legitimate, but the point is the country is falling apart. One is too many. One region is too many to be not on the seat of the political process. So I'm assuming our leaders will come to their heads, they will solve their divide or whatever their problems, and they will do something for the interests of the country, for the interests of the people. So nothing comes out because people are traumatized. Somebody have to know. Somalia is a country that has been in a civil war for a long time. They're pretty traumatized. Truth reconciliation was never performed. There's a lot of transitional issues. So we don't want to ignite anything that can cause problems for the country. So I'm assuming, I don't know what the implications are, but I know it's not good. They need to be united for the sake of the country, for the sake of the people, and come up with a political solution and political consensus.
Thanks, Hodan. Mahad, do you have anything to add on that question?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I think this is the process can be started, especially the election of the upper house members from Southwest, Hirshabelle and Galmudug. But that does not mean that Somalia can end this political transition without Puntland and Jubaland. And Somalia is a parliamentary system where these clan delegates will elect members of the parliament. Members of the parliament will then elect the president. And now you have parliamentarians from Jubaland, which is 48. Puntland 48, and Jubaland 51. That is a total of 99 MPs. So when you don't have 99 MPs out of 329, that's close to one third of the parliament. You cannot justify that. And it may polarize the already fragile situation and political climate. So I think consensus, as Dr. and Hodan said, is inevitable. We cannot go through this electoral process without key stakeholders that are agreeing on something and delivering it. So that is the challenge. I don't see any opportunity that somebody can organize parliamentary elections and then presidential elections without Jubaland and Puntland.
Thanks, Mahad. Thanks, Dr. Hodan. Going back to some of the questions in the Q&A, there's a question from Hannington about the acceptability of the electoral process in terms of popular opinion, public opinion. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, Mahad and Dr. Hodan, about the public mood at the moment in relation to these upcoming elections. Given that the system is similar to what happened in 2016, but expanded, how are people talking about the upcoming elections? Is there optimism? Is there fear? Yeah, what could you tell us about that?
Peter, I think the public opinion is different. And Somalia, we don't have polling centers that can give us some good picture of the line of thinking, what ordinary people are thinking. So it's relative. It's something that cannot be answered objectively. And but it's different. The public opinion is different, and there are many clan attached views. People maybe their perception are affected by their clan affiliations, that the context they live in, their friends, their affiliates. So it's something difficult to give a picture of, but. There is a feeling that whatever the process, the parliamentary process, if there is a peaceful transfer of power or peaceful elections, and people, different stakeholders, different politicians are allowed to compete, accept the result, I think the public will welcome that. And that has been the history for Somalia in the last two political transitions. Two sitting presidents have contested, and then they were defeated, and they accepted the result. And that is a cultural political history that Somalia wants to maintain. They want, the process is not good, it's flawed, it's not what we wanted, but at the end it may result in a change, in regime change, or change in the political leadership. So if that happens, many people will welcome. If the incumbent succeed, but with a peaceful and contested open process, that is most likely be welcomed as well. But any other, I think, an alternative would be difficult to accept. Maybe Dr. Hodan can add something to that.
I think people are anxious now. You're talking about when 2016, there was a peaceful transfer of power, but also a process was also agreed upon. And there was a huge political consensus. People are anxious because the process is still, of course, you have the opposition groups, the two regions who are contesting, and also the federal government. At this point, they should be on the same page. Now, they're not going to be unified. We expect the difference. But at least the political consensus of the process, I will underline the process three times. But the process is very important, and the people see that process to be fair, that everybody who has a stake is part of it and agreed upon, then whatever outcome will be accepted because the process is agreed upon. But now the issue we have is not who's going to become a president. We don't know that yet. And I'm sure there will be someone who will become the president of Somalia, whether it's current president or a new one. That outcome actually in Somalia, there are institutions without the law that always support the peaceful transfer of power. It happens in the regions. It happens in the capital more than three times now. I think this process, we need to concentrate on this process and the political consensus. To me, that's the answer that will take Somalia to the next level, to have a peaceful situation where people can agree upon the process. If the process is transparent, if the process is agreeable to all of us, this is a country that came out from war. Nobody has a bigger hand. It's just going to be a mess. So before that happens, we want the men to take a leadership and settle the issue. So the process is clear and transparent and agreed upon. It has to have a political consensus where everybody agreed. All the grievances can be solved. Somalis know, they do know how that can happen. And I'm sure, and I'm very confident, somehow I'm a little bit more optimistic that they will eventually come together, because I've seen many, many dire situations. And ultimately, somebody gives in, somebody gives up something, and they come together. I am hopeful that will happen because we have been in many, many bad situations. But ultimately, people come to their senses. And these leaders now, both from the regions and from the federal government, I think their intention is to have peaceful process where everybody agrees on the process and the process is transparent. And the most thing is the process is trusted. And the process is co-owned. There has to be ownership in the process. You have to have skin in the game. And I'm hoping that this will come together so there will be a peaceful election, and then we will accept, the outcome will be accepted. Thank you.
Thanks, both of you. There's a couple of questions here from Somali Cash Consortium, which I think are potentially interlinked. And the first of which is, what is the current model in the case of election disputes? So electoral dispute mechanisms, if we could have a word about that from either of you, please. And other slightly more general question about the timetable of the process. If we believe that the current timetable is too ambitious, given the current uncertainties, what kind of timeline would you recommend, or what kind of changes do you think would be necessary to allow this to go forward? So, any thoughts on those two questions about disputes and the timeline?
If I may take the dispute one, the process, you know, we look at history to predict the future. So the election disputed that was erected before, it was the Electoral Commission, headed by Halima. I think they did a good job in 2012 and 2016. And given the fact they are now part of the process and with their experience missing, it has to be embedded with the new Federal Election Committee or even the regional governors, the regional presidents and the president and the prime minister will have to come together. That's how it used to be, this election dispute committee. I don't think it's been established yet. Wasuga might have a little bit better answer. And I think that is one of the most important aspect of this whole election process. If there is ever dispute, and it will come, many of them will come, how it's going to be resolved, which group is going to resolve it, how we're going to select which state is going to bring who, and all that stuff. I think, I'm sure that's in the books and somewhere. I don't know if we have that election, the dispute committee, if they exist now, because there are many other issues. As far as the election and the timeline, I think it's expected. Remember in 2012, It was supposed to happen sometime in August. It was delayed for a couple of months. Also 2016, it was supposed to happen in October. It happened in February. So a few months is expected to, but the process was ongoing. There was no stagnation. So pending that there's no stagnation and there will be soon a political consensus, I think the timeline can be agreed upon and quickly move on to the next level. Thank you.
I think there is an agreed process for dispute resolution. It's very similar to 2016 electoral process with the establishment of electoral dispute resolution committee. This time it was agreed that it will consist of 21 members. 9 of them will be appointed by the federal government and federal member states will elect two each. But the problem is this committee will have short time to address reason and compliance related to and elections. And the agreement says that if they do not agree or could not address the issue, they have to forward that case to the National Consultative Council, which is a council by the federal president and presidents of federal member states. So they have to take the final decisions. And in that case, that the dispute resolution committee authority is limited. And the more important thing is that the National Consultative Council members are divided. They are not just even achieved to come together. The people are trying, we all know that the Prime Minister went to Garowe to invite President then to come to Mogadishu for the National Consultative Council meeting. And then that did not happen. So basically they are divided and they are not meeting regularly. So that is a challenge for the dispute resolution. The second thing is the timeline. It's really worrying situation. And one of the reasons why many people in Mogadishu are today worried about the elections is because of the timeline. They know that the mandate of the federal parliament ends in just 10 days. The 27th December will be the last day for the parliament. And the president's mandate will end on February 8th. 2021. So basically the president has just over 50 days and the parliament has just 10-11 days left for their mandate. And the electoral timeline that has been agreed on October 2nd states that the presidential election will happen on February 8th and the process will start in November 1st. And nothing has started. October, November, and now we are in the middle of December. That is what makes a lot of worry on a potential clash and a power vacuum. And I think the timeline needs to be renegotiated by stakeholders and agree on another realistic timeline. But the process has to start and the issues at hand needs to be fixed before the end of the mandate of the president. Otherwise, with this stagnant process, I think many people fear of election-related violence in Somalia, especially in Mogadishu.
Thanks, Mahad. And we've got two questions left in the chat that would be good to have some thoughts on. One of them is from Ulf Terlinden, HBS in Nairobi, which is, how do you assess the likelihood that the electoral standoff escalates into a military one, especially in Jubaland? So do either of you have any thoughts on that question? I mean, this question might also relate to the wider kind of regional geopolitical issues that we haven't touched on yet, potentially Kenya-Somalia relations, for example. But how do you assess the likelihood of a military escalation or confrontation in that context?
Okay, I think this is a likely scenario, and given the relationship, the worsening relationship between Somalia and Kenya, this is believed to be a friend of Jubaland administration. The situation may deteriorate in the next few weeks or days, but I think at the end of the day, we are Somalis, and the leaders, the federal leaders and Bhutan leaders need to come together and discuss on issues, contentious issues, especially the issue of ghetto seats. And one possible compromise, given the time frame we have, is that renegotiating the elect seats and the electoral constituencies, let me say. So in 2016, we had federal member state capitals being devolved with elections. And now it was increased to 2 in each federal member state. And now what we can think of, given the time we have, is renegotiating the constituencies and agreeing on one constituency in each federal member state, which is basically, which will give all the seats in the Gedo region now to be switched to XMIL. I'm not sure how leaders will entertain that. And another likely scenario is, as I said in my presentation, is splitting the seats in the Gedo region to two spheres of influence of the federal government and Jubaland. So there are a lot of compromises. Leaders want to agree on something. And I believe that international actors are also involved, especially the neighboring countries. But at the end of the day, the country is for the country of Somalia, and the leaders are leaders of this people and this country. So whatever decision they take, whatever disagreement they have, they can come together and do their differences. They are willing to do so.
Thanks, Mahad. Shall I move to the there's another question in the chat. This is the more general question from Ali Virgi. And the point here is that the current situation feels a lot like deja vu. Is there a path for things to be different next time, and what will it require to change? And so I think this is quite a general question. So I'd be interested in both of your reflections on this, whether you agree that this is sort of the same again in terms of deja vu, and maybe thinking about, well, what are the paths or trajectories for a greater level of change, perhaps in the process of political transition for the next political dispensation. Mahad or Dr. Hodan.
Maybe I can start with my views on this electoral process for the future. I think why we ended up another indirect election is that because we did not prioritize the elections. And we all know that the foundation for the elections, it is approval process, it is has been delayed. In fact, it was signed by the president in February this year. So you can understand that the electoral process has started very late. Elections has not been a priority in the first 2 to 3 years of the mandate of the federal government. If the next government just ignored the elections and did not start the process from the get-go, then we will again end up another enhanced indirect elections. So whatever the 2025 elections will look like will depend on how committed is the leadership, the new leadership that's expected in the country in early 2021, and how they invest time and resources and to build the necessary infrastructure for a one person, one vote nationwide elections in the country. Another important thing that Somalia can prioritize in the next, maybe in the next 2 years, is conducting local elections. And testing this nationwide one person, one vote election concepts and processes at micro level, at districts in Mogadishu, for instance. So if it can work in Mogadishu, it can work nationwide. So these are the kind of things that will give us in direction of the 2025 national elections.
I think I agree with Wasuge. We should think ahead. We should start with local elections, but at the same time, we need to plan. As soon as this election is over and a new administration comes to being, then there has to be a way to start the one person, one vote. Without that, because like Wasuga said, this process started very late and there was a lot of stop go, even though there was a lot of energy and effort and money that went into it, but it didn't materialize because it was just, we knew that was not going to happen. So the thing is for us to learn from the previous mistakes for 24 to 25, it's a good idea as soon as the election is over, the process of one person, one vote, how to do census, how to do the border things like that has to be implemented right away. And all the institutional and legal infrastructure should be in place. Many things that needs to be done before the election is, we have an election of one person, one vote. There are a lot of preconditions that needs to be in place before we even think about it. So I think it's a good lesson learned. At the same time, I need to mention there are local elections that are happening, and it's happening in a way that can happen in the future. So we can go to local elections like Puntland. They do have some other regions like Mogadishu. So this is a process that can be started at the local level, to the regional level, and then to the federal level. So these are the things that we need to think about, options we need to think about. But without implementation, without a legal and institutional infrastructure, it will be in someone's hand, and they can decide whether they want to proceed with it or whether they won't. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hodan. It's been a hugely interesting discussion. I'd like to thank both Mahad and Dr. Hodan hugely. Thank you so much, the two of you, for this. And thank you for RVI for hosting and HBS for hosting this discussion. I'm just going to pass back over to Pauline now to formally close the forum. So thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Peter, for moderating this session. And thank you to the panelists and, of course, to the attendees who joined us this afternoon. And thank you again, Hendrik Boyle Foundation, for the series. I think when we talk about Somali politics, it's so dynamic and so complex. And as Ali Vaji said, you know, is it deja vu again from the past elections that have happened? But I think from the thread that runs throughout the discussion, throughout this discussion and others that I've had before, is that lack of political will. And we do hope that, you know, after these elections, as Dr. Hodan has alluded, that the preparations will start early and not start a year before the actual elections are meant to happen. And it will be interesting also, I know we had a few international organizations attending, it would have been good to sort of have their reflections on what they're planning in the future elections. You know, how are they going to support the government to then make sure that all these institutions and processes are in place. As always, you know, women participation is always just a matter of waiting for elections for women to participate, but to actually be part of the process from the beginning. And as Dr. Hodan, you know, clearly said, you know, the participation has to be in the process and not just waiting for elections, and to be part of the whole electoral system and institutions and owning the process as well. So we wait and to see what happens in December, and then we wait for February. Something else that Peter, I think we had discussed previously and we didn't touch on was the regional dynamics, of course, with Kenya having a few tensions with Somalia, Kenya's relationship with Somaliland, Ethiopia going through what they're going through now and how that impacts Somalia, and also looking at other international dynamics, especially the Gulf states. So I think there's still more room and more scope to discuss this. Hopefully in 2021, Maha, Dr. Hodan, you can come back and sort of look, we can have a review in March to see, you know, what has happened and if there's any movement going forward. So asanteni sana for joining us. I'd like to wish you all happy holidays wherever you are. Please keep safe. And I hope everybody will be able to join us again come January. Peter, as always, thank you again for a very short notice. You agreed to moderate this session. Mahad, Asante, Dr. Hodan, thank you. Thank you very much. And have a good afternoon, a good morning, a good evening, wherever you are. Thank you very much.